The following is a rebroadcast of Stratford University's Tech Talk. To hear Tech Talk live, tune in Saturday mornings at 9. You can find us on the radio on 1500 AM, 104.5 FM, 103.5 FM HD2, 103.9 FM HD2, and 107.7 FM HD2. Or you can listen live online at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And this was also a busy week in technology. A man lost the password to his Bitcoin wallet.
That's a bad thing.
His Bitcoins are worth $220 million.
Wow.
And he only has two more attempts to try to log in, and then the hard drive will self-destruct.
Oh, that's bad.
That is bad news. Elon Musk saying people get off WhatsApp, go to Signal. WhatsApp shares too much of your data with Facebook, and he's just fed up with Facebook and all these guys that get our data and sell it.
Well, it's too late.
Yes?
Once you're there, right?
I know, you're stuck. But you can always try to reclaim yourself and rebuild your privacy going forward. Tim Berners-Lee is trying to start a company that's going to help us solve the privacy problem, because it is a huge, huge problem. There was an MIT professor who was charged with hiding work with China, and he was, arrested by the feds. The Chinese have been trying to infiltrate our universities, and this is an example that might be worth noting. Wikipedia celebrates its 20th anniversary. We'll go back and talk a bit about Wikipedia and where they're going. This week we're going to feature John Mauchly. John Mauchly, he's a man who along with Peter Eckert, developed the first general-purpose electronic digital computer, the ENIAC. And because of various shenanigans, he actually never got the patent for the ENIAC. And of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Yes, we got an email from Bob of Maryland, a longtime listener. Dear Doc, Jim, and the Furtive, Mr. Big Voice.
Oh, my.
Yes. I just stumbled onto this amazing hybrid insect electronic device, the Smellicopter.
Mm.
Researchers put a living antenna on a drone to give the machine an insanely keen sense of smell. The system monitors the electrical signal sent from the antenna of the actual device, allowing the drone to lock in on the source of a scent and navigate toward it. The antenna is from a hawk moth, the Monduca sexta. What do you think? All the best from your faithful listener, Bob in Maryland.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. That was a great idea. That was a great article. And this Smellicopter is a great idea. I think Jim actually has some footage of the Smellicopter.
I kind of misunderstood this. I thought it was a mix between a helicopter and a bug zapper. But here's what it would sound like if it did actually exist. There it goes. It's in flight. It's got to get to the mosquitoes first. But it's about there. It's honing in.
Ooh. Wow. You know, the bug zapper must have gotten it because of that moth antenna.
Yeah, it did. It did. It found it. It just imagine it would patrol your yard and just look for mosquitoes.
Wow. Well, this thing actually works. It actually hones in. I saw some footage of it. It actually hones in on the smell. It turns out that moth antenna are very sensitive in picking up smell. Just one molecule is enough to trigger an electrical signal, and then it's amplified dramatically. And so these antennas are extremely sensitive. Now, the problem is, once they cut the antenna off from the moth, it only lives for 4 hours.
Wow.
So they have to keep, every 4 hours, putting you know, putting on more antenna. But the so I don't know how practical this is going to be in the long term, but yeah. I thought the smellicopter was a very interesting idea.
All kinds of applications, I think.
We got an email from Jim Tilton in Bowie, Maryland. Hi, Dr. Schertz. I got another Windows update this week, and it caused my problem to reappear. Jim wrote an email last week. It turns out every time he gets an update, he plugs his earphones into his laptop, and then he wants to use the laptop mic. As soon as he plugs in the earphones, the mic stops working because it thinks there's a built-in mic with the earphones.
Right.
And so it just stops working, and he can't use it. And then he goes back, he works on it, and he finally gets it going again. So there was another update, and he was beside himself. So the amazing thing is he called Microsoft, and they started chatting with him. And they went through the whole rigmarole with him again. And he was on the phone quite a while with them, and they helped him reinstall his Windows 10 operating system. It took about 3 hours. So Jim said he reinstalled it, and now the problem's gone. It was a clean install, so apparently maybe some of the device drivers or something weren't correct. He did a clean install, and it fixed the problem. So that's great news, Jim. But for me, the real news is that Microsoft actually helped you.
Yeah, that's the headline.
That's the headline. And the guy chatted with them, and he said, look, if you've got any problems, here's a link. You can come right back to me, and you don't have to wait in line to get with me. And, I mean, I'm actually impressed that they stuck with Jim, because Jim's computer is an older computer, and it's really hard to get Windows to work on legacy systems. So they could have said, look, it's a legacy system, just get a new computer. But they stuck with him until the problem was solved.
I'm surprised.
Kudos to Microsoft. I'm actually surprised that Jim got that kind of response.
I'm surprised that this isn't the response that he got.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
You know,
yeah, that's right? What I would have expected. That's exactly what I would have expected. We got an email from John in Baltimore. Dear Tech Talk, I originally bought an HP laptop running Windows 10. And it keeps the wrong time. It's always an hour behind. Now, if I change to the correct time, it just reverts back to the wrong time all on its own when I go back the next day. Do you think it might be a bad CMOS battery or maybe a bad motherboard? I'd like to get this fixed while my machine is still under warranty, John in Baltimore. Well, John, the problem is most certainly not a hardware problem since it keeps consistent, although incorrect time all the time. I suspect that when you set up your original operating system when the machine was new, that you picked out the wrong time zone. And so, you know, when you're going through the installation, it says, what time zone are you in? I suspect you picked the wrong time zone. So here's what you want to do to fix this. Just boot up your PC in Windows, right click on the display in the lower right hand corner of the screen, and then click on adjust time and date. You know, adjust time and date. And you're basically right-clicking on the time and date down in the lower right-hand corner, and just click on adjust time and date. And then what you want to do, you want to toggle off set time zone automatically so you can set the time zone manually. This automatic time zone setting is useful if you're traveling and you change your computer time zone, although I turned it off in my case because when I travel, I want to be on local time, so when I set up meetings, they're set up correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just select the time zone for your location from the drop-down menu in the center of the screen. Make sure that you put down adjust for daylight savings time automatically, and then exit the date and time utility, and that ought to be all you have to do to fix this problem. And best of luck with that. We got an email from Azra in Fredericksburg. Dear Doc and Jim, I'd like to set up my own YouTube channel. I got a Mac, I got an iPhone 10, and an iPad. How can I monetize the site? What do you suggest for my first action? Should be Azra in Fredericksburg. Well, actually, Azra, setting up a YouTube channel has become a popular thing these days because people are making real money. There's some boy, young boy, 9-year-old, all he does is unbox toys. His parents take videos of him. His channel makes $30 million a year, if you can imagine that.
What,
and there's
$30 million?
Another case of a woman, she just speaks in Vietnamese. She's just everyday life in America. She speaks in Vietnamese. The first year she made $100,000. This is the fourth year of her channel. She's going to make $800,000. So people are making real money on YouTube channels. So I can see why you're kind of interested. It should be a fun project. Now, it got to be something that's a passion of yours. You know, you know, because you're going to have to be making videos over and over and over again. So you want something that's a passion that you're really serious about. Now, what you want to do is you need a Gmail address first. So you're going to have to set up your Gmail account. I'd suggest you get a Gmail account that has something to do with your channel, and that Gmail account would be just used with the channel. Now log into YouTube with your new Gmail account and click on the little account circle up in the right. That it could have a picture in it if you put a picture in it, and. And then you can click on your channel, and then it'll ask you to set up a channel, to create a channel. So it'll create a channel. Now, if you want to get a brand account, that means you want a channel which has a different name than your YouTube account. You can do that. And so you can create a brand account. You can give your YouTube channel a name which is different than your email account. And when you set that up, Google will say, okay, we'd like you to fill out a few things. You'll have to put a 1,000-word description of what your channel will be. So you need kind of a good idea of what you want to do. Now, Google also has what they call playlists in YouTube channels. So like if you go to somebody's channel, you don't just want to randomly, you know, start picking videos. So the YouTube operators, they'll take a bunch of videos, they'll put them all together in a playlist. So a user can come in and just pick a playlist and all those videos just play one after another, just like an audio playlist. And so you want to pick out a few playlists that are relevant to the kind of videos that you're going to be making. And you can describe each playlist, in this case, was up to 5,000 words. So that's setting up the channel. But now you don't have any content. So now you got to get some content, and that's the big job. Now your iPhone is a perfect camera for setting up a YouTube channel. It's a great camera. Now I would recommend though that when you take videos, you use the main camera, not the selfie camera, the camera on the back of the phone, because you've got three lenses. You've got wide field of view, narrow field of view, and medium field of view. And with those three lenses, you've got higher resolution too. You can take better videos. Now, the YouTube channel they're all organized as landscape. In other words, you got to turn the phone on the side. If you take your videos with the phone vertically, you're just going to get the middle third of the screen showing the video. If you want to fill the entire screen in the YouTube channel, you have to turn your phone sideways and run in the landscape mode. Now, here's the most important thing when you set up your YouTube channel and you need video. You need videos. You've got to have good sound. You see, you could watch really a crummy video if it has good sound. You could have a great video, and if it has bad sound, you just can't stand to watch it. You've got to have good sound. And it turns out that while the iPhone has a great camera, it does not have a very good microphone. And when you get more than 3 feet away from the camera, the sound is just not very good. You pick up a lot of wind noise. So you're going to need an external mic to the iPhone.
Yep.
Now, I would suggest you get a wireless mic, a lavalier that you just, you know, put in your collar. And I looked around, and the prices are all over the place, from $60 up to $300. I sort of picked one out for you in the mid-range, the Movo WMX1 1.24 gigahertz wireless microphone. It's $119. It's got a 200-foot range, and you can plug the receiver into the iPhone, and then you can plug the transmitter into the lavalier microphone, and you'll have great sound. You can walk around, and you could have videos where you're walking toward the camera, away from the camera. That would be a great option. Now, Movo did have a wireless mic where the one unit, the receiver, just plugs right into the cell phone. But a lot of people didn't like it because they had to take the cell phone cover off for it to work. And also, it was limited to only the cell phone. You couldn't plug it into a camera. you know, which would take movies. And I'm thinking that if this really takes off for you, you'll probably end up getting a dedicated camera. And this particular unit would work for a dedicated camera. Now, because you're going to be wanting to take photos from the other side of the camera, you're not going to really, when you're when you've got the camera mounted on a tripod, you can't see yourself because the picture's on the other side. So there's a great little app that you can use, and you say you've got an iPad, which is perfect. It's called the Filmic Pro Remote Control Camera Kit, Filmic, F-I-L-M-I-K, Remote Control Camera Kit. And so what that does, you install the Remote Control Pro on your iPhone, and the Remote Control Filmic, the Filmic remote on your iPad, and then you can link the two together. You can either link with the Wi-Fi in your house, or if you're out and about outside, it'll do a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi linking, and you don't have to be around a Wi-Fi signal that you would have in your home. So the nice thing is then what the camera sees, you see on your iPad. So you can set the picture up perfectly, and you can turn the camera on, turn the camera off. You can set which lens you want, narrow field of view, wide field of view, medium field of view. You can set all the image things here. And if you want, if somebody's helping you, they could hold the iPad and they would be like the director, and they could run the thing. So that Filmic Pro remote camera kit, which includes both the remote as well as the camera, it's $19.99 if you download it from Apple, and it is just a nice little application. I really like it. Now, when you're outside, you're not going to need lighting probably, but when you're inside, you will need a light, and these selfie rings are pretty good. These LED selfie rings are pretty good, and you can get, they have different color temperatures, so you can set them. So there's a 12-inch selfie ring. It comes with a tripod. You've got to have a tripod. They can get from Walmart for $35. So I'd say for your indoor videos, get that selfie ring. Then you're going to want to get a tripod for the camera that has a mount that will hold your iPhone horizontally. And I just went down to Walmart. I was kind of interested in it. For $35, you get really a nice tripod with that kind of mount. So You're pretty much set. Now you could put your camera up on your tripod on the inside. You could turn on your selfie light, and then you could use your iPad to control the camera. And so you could take self, and then you have your wireless mic where you're linking to the camera, which means you don't have to be within 3 feet of the camera, and your sound will be so much better. Or you could go outside and take some great videos. If you have somebody else, suppose turn the camera on, turn it off, and you could actually operate quite nicely that way. Now, what you're going to find out is you cannot monetize your site until you have 1,000 users and you have 400 hours of view time in a year. Once you do that, you can request YouTube to place ads on your YouTube channel, and you share in the revenue. You get 2/3 of the revenue, and Google gets 1/3 of the revenue. So, the one other thing that you may want to get is a green screen. With the green screen, you can add a background to your video after the fact. You know, like if you watch the weather on TV, he's standing in front of a green screen and they're simply putting the weather map digitally putting the weather map behind him, but there's nothing behind him except the green screen.
But here's the important thing about green screens. Don't wear green when you're standing in front of a green screen.
That is exactly right. If you wear green, your body will be invisible.
You'll be a head and hands, and that's it.
Yeah, you'll be a head and hands. So with the green screen, you basically, if you're on the inside, then you can put any picture you want behind you. Just hang that from the ceiling, and just you could put a curtain rod, hang it from the ceiling, then that's dirt cheap, and you could just get the green screen material at only about $35. Now, the final thing you need for this project, you've got to be able to edit your videos, okay? And it turns out that you've got the perfect laptop for it. You've got a Mac, and the iMovie video editing application that Apple has is a great one for beginners. you can basically, you can drag your videos together on a timeline, you can splice them together, you can add title screens, you can add writing, you can put in a series of stills, and you can just put them on the timeline, and then you can put in music, and then you can overlay on top of that voice, so you can make a slideshow into a movie. It has all of that. Plus, if you've got green screen, you can just drop the picture in, and iMovie will automatically put in your picture behind you in place of the green screen. It's intuitive to use. It comes with the Mac. So I'd recommend iMovie. So you've got everything you need, and if you take the wireless mic, the tripods, and the selfie light, and the application Filmic Pro, you're spending less than $250,000 to get started. But I think you will have a lot of fun with that, and I wish you the best of luck. And when you finally get your channel set up, tell me what the name of it is, and I'll go back and take a look at it. Listen, we love your emails.
Yep.
Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Network, 1500 AM, 103.5 FM HD2, 103.9 FM HD2. If you're listening in Loudoun County, it's 104.5 FM. And southwest of Washington, you can hear us on 107.7 FM HD2. We'll be back in a minute.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
In the next 3 years, there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity jobs. How can you make that work for you? Stratford University offers everything you need to succeed, from certifications to bachelor's and even master's degrees in cybersecurity, to prepare you for a rewarding career in today's most lucrative and sought-after field, cybersecurity. Stratford has seasoned IT faculty, well-equipped labs, and real-life scenarios to help you achieve practical solutions to today's newest challenges. And Stratford makes a cybersecurity career a reality with accelerated classes, year-round program starts, and both on-campus and online options to fit your busy schedule. All disciplines are offered, including digital forensics, networking and telecommunications, and our full line of degrees, including a master's in cybersecurity. Find the future of you with a future in cybersecurity. Go to stratford.edu/cybersecurity today. That's stratford.edu/cybersecurity.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature John William Motchley. John William Motchley is an American physicist who, along with J. Presper Eckert, designed ENIAC, the first general-purpose electronic digital computer. John Motchley was born August 30th, 1907, in Cincinnati, Ohio. When John was eight, his family moved to Chevy Chase, Maryland. So he's a lucky local boy
yeah.
Here in D.C. His father was head of a section of the terrestrial electricity at the Carnegie Institute of Washington, D.C.
That's funny. I need to pay my terrestrial electricity bill. Thank you for the reminder.
Yes, that's in the old days, wasn't it? Terrestrial
yes.
Electricity. Now, as a youth, Motchley loved science, and he particularly liked electricity. And as a teenager, he had all pick up all kinds of odd jobs fixing his neighbor's electric systems. If anybody had anything broken, he'd want to go for it, and that's the kind of work that he liked. He graduated from McKinley Technical High School in downtown Washington, D.C. Now, at McKinley, Motchley was active on the debate team. He was a member of the National Honor Society, and he became editor-in-chief of the school's newspaper, Tech Life. In 1925, he got a scholarship to study engineering at Johns Hopkins University. But after only 2 years, he got fed up with engineering and needed to decide to go into a real field. So he transferred to the physics department. And without completing his bachelor's degree, he enrolled directly into the PhD program. And he received a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins in 1932. In that same year, he was accepted. He accepted a teaching position at Ursinus College in Philadelphia. Now, from 32 to 33, he served at research assistant at Johns Hopkins, where he calculated energy levels of the formaldehyde spectrum. And then it was in 33 that he went to Ursinus College and was appointed. He was head of the physics department at Ursinus College. That's the good news.
I can see
the bad news is there was only one staff member in the department.
Well, it's easy to be the head when it's a department of one.
That's right.
I can see why you're interested in this guy.
One, physics, and two,
he fixed electrical things as a kid. And didn't you rewire your parents' kitchen?
Yeah, I did. I like to play with terrestrial electricity too.
I can tell.
Okay, in 36, Motchley accepted a job as assistant physicist at the Carnegie Institute to analyze meteorological data. Now, there was a lot of computer work there, so that actually stimulated his interest in computation. Now, in the summer of 1941, he took a defense training course for electronics at the University of Pennsylvania Moore School of Electrical Engineering. While he was there taking that course, he met the lab instructor, J. Presper Eckhart, and they formed a long-standing partnership. Now, following the course, Motchley was hired as an instructor of electrical engineering there at the Moore School of Electrical Engineering. And in 1943, he was promoted to assistant professor of EE. He got the idea of making a high-speed electronic computer using flip-flop circuits that were used in cosmic ray counting devices. He'd seen those flip-flop circuits in action at Swarthmore College. And he said, why don't we use these flip-flop circuits? And they would either be on or off, symbolizing a bit that's either on or off. So we thought, why don't we make an electronic computer using flip-flop circuits? So he wrote a proposal to the Army. He gave it to Lieutenant Herman Goldstein. And they proposed a high-speed electronic computer to solve some of the problems that the Army had in calculating ballistic trajectories. Okay, in April of 1943, the Army contracted with the Moore School to build the electronic numerical integrator and computer. That's where ENIAC comes from, electronic numerical integrator and computer.
I wondered where that came from.
Yeah. Now, Motchley led the conceptual design, while Eckhart led the hardware engineering on the ENIAC. It was 1,000 times faster than the current methods they had for calculating trajectories. It could do 357 10-digit multiplications in 1 second, which at that time was lightning fast. Now, they froze the design of the ENIAC in 1944 to start doing construction. Then they planned to build a second computer called the EDVAC. Now, at that time, John von Neumann learned of the project, and he analyzed the ENIAC. He wrote a report, first draft of a report on EDVAC. Oh, yeah, he came back. He was going to write on the EDVAC before it was actually built. Now, dated June 30th, 1945, it was a written account of the general purpose stored computing machine EDVAC. And John von Neumann wrote it. But prior to that paper being published, Goldstein, who also had John von Neumann under contract, removed Eckhart and Motchley's name. So John von Neumann wrote the report, and Eckhart and Motchley got no credit for the work. Mm. And then Goldstein distributed that document widely to all of von Neumann's associates. That paper defined the von Neumann architecture. And because the von Neumann architecture that was outlined in the paper that was describing the EDVAC was published before he applied for a patent, His patent was denied because they said the von Neumann architecture predated that patent, even though that was his idea in the paper. So they weren't very happy about that, losing that patent. Then the Moore School of Engineering, they said, wait a minute here, this computer stuff, this might make us a lot of money. So they changed their patent policy, and they said if any of the professors invent something while they're working at the Moore School of Engineering owns the patents. At that point, Eckhart and Motchley resigned. They said, well, enough's enough. We already lost the first patent because of the Goldstein, because of the contract administrator. We're not going to lose our other patents because the Moore School wants them. So they formed the Eckhart Motchley Computer Corporation, EMCC. Motchley was president. They then secured a contract with the National Bureau of Standards to build EDVAC 2, which later became a machine that I'm sure you've heard of, Jim, UNIVAC.
Yes. We've discussed UNIVAC ad infinitum, yeah, or have we not?
We have. So UNIVAC was the first computer designed specifically for business application. And it had many technical advantages, including, at that time, something truly innovative, magnetic tape for mass storage. Now, Motchley, however, believed that language, computer language, was really important if you wanted to make these useful. So he hired Grace Murray Hopper to develop a compiler for the UNIVAC. Now, you know, you take computer language, then you got to convert it into machine language, and then you feed the zeros and ones into the computer. And the program that converts the computer language to the machine language is called a compiler. And Grace Murray Hopper invented the compiler. And we've featured her before. So they actually hired the compiler pioneer to write the compiler for the UNIVAC. Now, the problem is,
did they know at that point, you know, how important she was? I guess they did.
Well, they knew that she'd written a compiler. I don't know that they knew that she would become a luminary at that point, because this was right at the beginning of her career. The problem is, these were just two college professors. They didn't have a lot of money. And, of course, they lost out on the original patent of the of their ENIAC and EDVAC. So they didn't have much money, and they didn't get another contract. NBS gave them one contract, that they couldn't get another contract. So they're running out of cash. So unfortunately, they had to sell their company along with all the computer patents that they got after they left the Moore School of Engineering. They had this. They sold the company along with all the patents to Remington Ram. Now, Marchley worked for Remington and later for Sperry, which bought Remington Ram for about 9 years. And then he finally left. In 1959, he left Sperry Rand, as it became. So when Sperry bought Remington Rand, it became Sperry Rand. So he left Sperry Rand, and he started Marchley Associates. And one of the big achievements of Motchley Associates was the development of the critical path method for providing automated construction scheduling. So if you ever heard about a project management, you create a critical path, and that is the path which defines the timeline on the project. And the only way to shorten the project is to shorten the critical path. So he developed the critical path method for doing construction scheduling. Motchley also set up a consulting organization, Data Trends, and in 1967, and he worked as a consultant to Sperry UNIVAC from 1973 until 1980. So he continued to consult with them even after he left. Motchley retired to the quiet suburb of Philadelphia, Ambler, Pennsylvania. He died January 8th, 1980, of complications from an infection. In 2002, he was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. So there's everything you need to know about John William Motchley, the co-developer, and actually he invented the concept of the general purpose electronic digital computer.
Hope you were paying attention, because coming up, you can win a free prize by gaining us and showing us your knowledge here on Tech Talk Radio, heard on Federal News Network. 1500 AM, 103.5 FM HD2, 103.9 FM HD2, and now in the vast southwestern listening audience south of D.C., 107.7 FM HD2 in Loudoun County. Catch us on 104.5 FM. Learn about the programs at Stratford University by going to stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
In the next 3 years, there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity jobs. How can you make that work for you? Stratford University offers everything you need to succeed, from certifications to bachelor's and even master's degrees in cybersecurity, to prepare you for a rewarding career in today's most lucrative and sought-after field, cybersecurity. Stratford has seasoned IT faculty, well-equipped labs, and real-life scenarios to help you achieve practical solutions to today's newest challenges. And Stratford makes a cybersecurity career reality with accelerated classes, year-round program starts, and both on-campus and online options to fit your busy schedule. All disciplines are offered, including digital forensics, networking and telecommunications, and our full line of degrees, including a master's in cybersecurity. Find the future of you with a future in cybersecurity. Go to stratford.edu/cybersecurity today. That's stratford.edu/cybersecurity.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Live from Washington, it's the Stratford University Pop Quiz with Andrew Mitchell, Jim Ross, featuring Mr. Big Voice, with musical guest, the Stratford University Junkyard Band, and your host, Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, thank you. I just love this audience.
Yeah.
But this is not simply a radio show, as I'm going to remind them very shortly.
Yes.
This is a classroom of the airways.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see whether they have been listening. We do that with the pop quiz. If they get the right answer to the pop quiz, they'll get two tickets to fine dining when our dining rooms open after the pandemic. And they'll also receive an A-plus for today's show.
I'm interested in the A-plus, really.
Yeah, that's valuable.
Uh-huh.
You know, get a transcript, everything. It's probably a collector's item.
Will you sign it?
Earlier in the show, I talked about John William Motchley. He, of course, is the co-developer of the first general-purpose electronic digital computer. Now, when he was young, he earned money doing something for his neighbors. What might that have been?
If you know the answer to today's question, now's your chance to win something. Pick up the phone, give us a call. If you're dialing from west of the Rockies, it's 877-936-9333. If you're enjoying the winter solitude east of Playa del Schertz, Virginia, it's 877-936-9333. If you've forgotten to pay your terrestrial electricity bill in Canada, call us on the wildcard line, 877-936-9333. Anyone else, anywhere else may call us on the international line. It's sanitized hourly with an anodized metal baton, 877-936-3933. Now, once again, here's Dr. Richard Schertz.
There he goes, picking on Canada again.
I know, that is just terrible. That is terrible.
You
Let's talk
outraged.
About the mistake of the week.
Okay.
The lost Bitcoin password. Stefan Thomas, a German programmer based in San Francisco, forgot a password that would allow him to access 7,002 Bitcoins that could be worth, as of today, about $220 million.
Yikes.
Now, the password would allow Thomas to unlock a small hard drive called the Iron Key that he put them in there just to make certain they would be secure. And the Iron Key holds the keys to the digital wallet that contains the 7,002 Bitcoins. Now, Thomas lost the paper where he wrote down the password to the iron key long ago. Now, the way this is set up, you only have so many attempts at unlocking it, and then it just totally encrypts the data so it can never be reached. He only has two more attempts of a failed, two more attempts to try to unlock it, and then it's gone forever. Now, he actually got this cryptocurrency back in 2011. He lived in Switzerland, and he made an animated video explaining what is Bitcoin. And, you know, and then, you know, apparently people sent him Bitcoins. Back then, they weren't worth very much. He collected these Bitcoins as a result of that thing. And so he, but it wasn't a big deal in 2011, but it's a big deal now because Bitcoin has gone through the roof. Now, Thomas is not the only one who's lost his money in this way. Of the existing 18.5 million Bitcoins, about 20% of them believed to be lost or in stranded wallets like this one.
A stranded wallet.
And those 20% of the Bitcoins that are lost or in stranded wallets are worth $140 billion.
Holy cow.
So Stefan Thomas is not the only guy. So Stefan, I hope you can find that document, or I hope you can have a dream and figure out the password.
We do not have a winner yet. If you would please, Doctor, ask the question once again.
Okay. Earlier in the show, I talked about John William Motchley. He, of course, developed the first general purpose electronic computer. Now, he was interested in science and in electricity, and he was known to take odd jobs with his neighbors, you know, to earn a little extra money. What kind of odd jobs would he be taking with his neighbors?
And the number to call is 877-936-9333. Now plot on, please.
Elon Musk tells his followers to use the Signal messaging app. Now, the encrypted messaging app, Signal, has just seen a huge boost in users after Tesla CEO Elon Musk tweeted out that his followers should use the service. Now, there was such a rush to download the Signal messaging app that they basically had trouble sending out verification codes for a while with that initial push, but now they've managed to solve that problem. Now, the reason that Musk tweeted this is that it was only a two-word tweet, use Signal. You see, Signal is an encrypted messaging app. It's point-to-point encrypted, so nobody in the middle can see what your message is. And it turns out that WhatsApp uses the Signal protocol. But Facebook recently changed the privacy standards on WhatsApp, and they said that all the data that they gather in WhatsApp is going to be passed and shared with Facebook. And there was a list of all the data that WhatsApp collects. It was enormous. And people are up in arms over this. So Elon Musk said, look, why would you stick with Facebook and use WhatsApp? Use Signal. FaceApp uses the encryption standard developed by Signal. But the good thing with Signal, they're a nonprofit corporation. They're not about trying to make money on your data. And so they're trying to do something that's good. And so a lot of people are switching over to Signal. Now, Facebook, in response to this big hubbub, they have delayed that switchover on sharing data with Facebook. And they're saying, well, really, we don't share that much data. It's not that big of a deal, but nobody believes them. And, you know, because Facebook is a business focused on mining people's data and making money on your data, whereas Signal is a nonprofit foundation, and it's even gone as far as to accept venture capital funding to prevent financial profit from driving its focus.
Well, Doc, we don't have a winner yet, so would you please ask the question again? We'll go to break and come back and do observations from the bunker, because I know you got to get into the right mental space for that.
I certainly do. Yeah, yes. Earlier in the show, I talked about John William Motchley. He, of course, was co-developer of the first general purpose electronic digital computer. What kind of work did he have? What kind of work did he do for his neighbors to make money that sort of aligned with his interests?
And here's a clue. Dr. Schertz has done the same thing, and here's the number to call.
877-936-9333.
It is Saturday morning, and you are listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Network, 1500 AM, 103.5 FM HD2, 103.9 FM HD2, southwest of D.C. Catch us on 107.7 FM HD2 or in Loudoun County on 104.5 FM. Find out more about what's happening at Stratford University by going to stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
In the next 3 years, there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity jobs. How can you make that work for you? Stratford University offers everything you need to succeed, from certifications to bachelor's and even master's degrees in cybersecurity, to prepare you for a rewarding career in today's most lucrative and sought-after field, cybersecurity. Stratford has seasoned IT faculty, well-equipped labs, and real-life scenarios to help you achieve practical solutions to today's newest challenges. And Stratford makes a cybersecurity career a reality with accelerated classes, year-round program starts, and both on-campus and online options to fit your busy schedule. All disciplines are offered, including digital forensics, networking, and telecommunications, and our full line of degrees, including a master's in cybersecurity. Find the future of you with a future in cybersecurity. Go to stratford.edu/cybersecurity today. That's stratford.edu/cybersecurity.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Observations from the bunker.
New year, new door? I think not.
Why? Yes, indeed. No, this week, I tell you, down in the bunker, I've been sort of pondering the power of the tech overlords.
Yeah.
Now, these are the people that run Amazon, that run Google, that run Apple, that run Twitter, the tech overlords. It seems like they can do whatever they want. They can control our communication channels in any way they want. And so I started thinking about who bears responsibility for the real-world consequences of technology? And this particular question has been made more complicated because of legislation that was passed decades ago, and actually in 1966, that provides absolute immunity for these platforms for any kind of liability for actions that they might take. This, of course, is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It was written before Facebook or YouTube or Twitter even existed. And there were just basically bulletin boards that were up there, and people would just post things on bulletin boards. And it was designed to shield the bulletin board platforms from, you know, from being sued for what somebody might post. And the one sentence has been, and so the sentence that was in the legislation was says this: no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as a publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So these platforms will not be considered, will be treated as a publisher. That one word in there, provider, has been interpreted as including social media platforms and for all the content that they host. Now, in theory, Section 230 was written to give the internet room to flourish without fear of lawsuits. But what has happened with these tech overlords, they're basically invincible. Nobody can sue them for whatever they do. They can do whatever they want, and nobody has anything because they've got blanket immunity from Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Now, many people on both sides of the aisle think this needs to be changed because it is dangerous, because they might go after your buddy. They might go after you today, but they're going to go after your buddy tomorrow. Or so eventually somebody's going to be in their sights who crosses them, and you don't know who that's going to be. So it's time, I believe, to regulate big tech, get rid of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act so that they can be held accountable for actions they take. And maybe that will help regularize the situation.
All right, Doc, we have somebody who'd like to play the game.
Okay.
Let us go to line one, and this is MC calling from Silver Spring. Good morning, MC. How are you?
All is well, Jim.
Good. Doc? All right. Doc, go ahead and ask the question, please.
Early in the show, I talked about John William Maudslay. He was a co-developer of the first general-purpose electronic computer. What did he do for his families when he was growing up as a lot of jobs?
Yeah, he picks odd electrical jobs for his neighbors.
There you go.
Oh,
excellent.
Very good. Perfect.
Very good work there, MC. Hang on a second and get your information, and we'll send you back to Andrew for that. Doc, I think because of the time, we just keep it here and you just continue talking on because we are all about content.
100%. Tim Berners-Lee, of course, who is the man who invented the World Wide Web, he invented the browser, is trying to tackle internet privacy. He's getting at this issue that Elon Musk talked about, you know, these companies like Facebook and Twitter and all just selling your data. So that's dangerous. This topic, by the way, was suggested by Bob in Maryland, and I thought it was really good. So Tim Berners-Lee has started a new company, a startup called Inrupt. Inrupt, I-N-R-U-P-T, Inrupt. His goal is to fix some of the problems that have disrupted the internet in our time. I mean, huge corporations like Facebook and Twitter are operating closed platforms. And as such, he argues the user has lost control. In the beginning, the internet was powerful because the user had absolute control. But these guys have so much power on these closed platforms that the user is like a victim of the tech overlords. So Berners-Lee plan is to take back the data that people have so that they can keep it private, so they control their data. He thinks that it's important for people to keep their own data in their own hands, and they only decide who should be able to see it. So the goal of Inrupt is to develop a single sign-on service where personal data is stored in pods. That's personal online data storage, and controlled by the individual user. Now, he got this idea. He actually had a pilot program with the National Health Service, and the BBC, and the government services in Flanders, where they were testing it. And what they were doing there, they were basically dealing with medical data, so people could store their medical data privately. I mean, that's an issue. You don't want somebody to know all the diseases that you've got. So they created pods for medical data, and this was extremely successful way to control access to your private data. So then Tim Berners-Lee got the idea. He says, well, the application could be far broader than just medical data. We could spread it across the entire internet. So you can see what would happen if everybody would, say, log on to Facebook with pods. That would keep all their personal data away from Facebook, and Facebook would not be able to make money on your data. So I actually hope he's successful at this at this new endeavor, because I think the tech overlords have crossed the line, and I think it's time to bring them back in line. Now, he's hoping that he can launch this thing over the next few years, and if it gets traction, I think we could do something about this privacy issue. Now, let's talk about this MIT professor that got charged for hiding work that he did for China. He's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's charged with hiding work that he did for the Chinese government. This is kind of a problem that we've had with research at our institutions, as China's trying to basically steal intellectual property from the U.S. His name was Gang Chen, 56. He was arrested by federal agents at his home in Cambridge on charges that included wire fraud. While working for MIT, Chang entered into undisclosed contracts and held appointments with Chinese entities, including acting as an overseas expert for the Chinese government at the request of the People's Republic of China Consulate Office in New York. Now, Chen did not disclose these connections to China, as was required in the federal grant applications process. Because what he did, his group collected from all of these foreign activities, $29 million in foreign dollars, including much money from the Chinese government. But this was the problem. He also got $19 million from U.S. federal agencies for his work at MIT since 2013. So he was funded by the federal government to do research for the U.S. government, and without telling the U.S. government that he had these other contracts, he was also doing work and sharing the results of his research with other countries, including China. And the government said it's okay to work for other countries, but it's not okay to lie about it. Now, Chen's attorney said the professor loves the U.S. and looks forward to vigorously defending all of the allegations. MIT said it's deeply distressed. They believe that the integrity of research is a fundamental responsibility that they take seriously, and they hope to mend fences with the federal government. Now, Wikipedia celebrates its 20th birthday.
Wow.
On January 15th, it was 20 years old. That's just yesterday. And it was founded January 15th, 2001, by Jimmy Wales, an American-British entrepreneur. It's now the seventh most popular site. It's got more than 55 million articles, and it's consulted 15 billion times a month. The website started in English, but within 2 months, it had already launched German and Swedish. It now is available in 309 languages. You can imagine. In 2006, Wales set the goal of having 100,000 entries in Wikipedia for every language with more than 1 million speakers. In every language that has more than 1 million speakers. Now, he recognized that Wikipedia is still 20 years from achieving that goal. Now, Wikipedia is a nonprofit, so really, Jimmy Wales doesn't make money from it. And it's an outlier because it's a nonprofit. It's unlike Google and Facebook, we're in it for the bucks.
Yep.
I mean, Wikipedia harkens back to the days when we had open source and we wanted to give back to the world for a better place, you know, before this greedy profit motive came in to sort of create these tech overlords. Now, Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales acknowledges that in the beginning, he was afraid somebody else would create an online collaborative encyclopedia before he did. So he rushed to get it out. Now, Wikipedia is all driven by volunteers, and each language is built up independently. They just don't translate articles from one to another. They actually build them up. They build them up independently, and contributions are from non-experts. Listen, I love Wikipedia. I've contributed to it, and I think it's a great resource. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. And go check out the Stratford University website, www.stratford.edu, and tell them that you heard about all of their programs on Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio is sponsored by Stratford University. For more information on courses at Stratford University, call 1-800-444-0804. Thanks for listening to Tech Talk Radio Online.